Hi, I'm Matt.
And I'm Joe. We're the NC Wine Guys. Welcome to Cork Talk.
In this episode, we sit down with Bob Binns, Corey Littleberg, and Justin Taylor from Parker Binns Vineyard in Mill Spring, North Carolina.
We were very happy that Bob, Corey, and Justin could join us for this great conversation. We had such a good time that we decided to make this a two-part episode.
Wine Class with the Wine Mouths is back. Join us as they take us through the next chapter in the history of wine.
This episode is made possible in part by a grant from the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council. You can learn more about the council by going to their website, ncwine.org. So sit back, pour a glass, and listen.
Do you need me to redo that whole thing? If you want to do this episode, it's possible.
So today we are not at home. We're not doing this virtually. We're actually live in person. We're in Mill Spring, North Carolina, with the fine folks at Parker Binns. So let's go around the mics, if we will, and everyone can introduce themselves and tell everyone who you are and what you do here. But let's start with the man himself, Bob.
I'm Bob Binns. My job here has been relegated to doing nothing. The young people have more or less put me out to pasture. But I still overlook everything and make sure the pastures are properly groomed and fertilized and that sort of thing. So that's about what I do today.
So do you have like a throne and a crown?
Oh, I do.
And,
oh, you
and a scepter?
It's beautiful, yes. I sit up there on my throne and watch TV, read books, and drink wine.
I want your life, Bob.
No, you don't, believe me. You don't want to be in this body. They get old and creaky.
You're doing pretty well for yourself. Bob just told us he celebrated 88 years a few days ago. So happy birthday, Bob.
Well, thank you.
My name is Corey Littleberg. I'm the GM and the vineyard manager here at Parker Binns, Bob's grandson. And I came here, started in 2019 full-time, and I've sort of grown into a role of doing a little bit of everything with my primary focus being the vineyard.
And I'm Justin Taylor. I'm the winemaker here. I know that might seem like a narrow title, but we've put a lot into building out something that Bob and Karen started, and they've given me a lot of free rein in being able to not only pursue creative projects, but try and push the envelope for what could be and not just accept where we are. So it's been a tremendous opportunity to work with them.
Excellent.
So Bob, let's maybe start at the beginning. How did you and Karen get started here in Mill Spring with a vineyard?
Well, it goes back to probably the late 1990s. We had a tree farm, grew palm trees and tropical hardwoods, and we had a plant nursery in South Florida. And one morning, like every morning, Karen and I are at the potting bench, and it's July, and the perspiration is running off me, and it's 7 o'clock in the morning. So I say, Karen, we need to go to the damn mountains in the summer. We're getting too old for this. So we talked it over, and we decided we would look. So we drove up to, well, we checked out northern Georgia and South Carolina, North Carolina. We even went as far as going into Virginia and looking. But I had one criteria. I took a compass and I put it in Fort Lauderdale and I drew a circle, and I had to figure what I could do in a day's drive, because I had a boat in the water in my backyard. And the most important thing to me in those days was to make sure my boat survived any hurricane that might come up. So this was on the fringe of the 10-hour drive from Fort Lauderdale. And so we liked the Lake Lure area, and we drove around the area. It was in 2006 or 2007. We had a very hard time finding any property. It was at the height of the boom, and nobody wanted to sell. Everybody thought things were going to keep going higher and higher and higher. So we finally found 10 acres here in Polk County, and we liked the land. We liked the layout and everything. So we bought it. There was an old chicken coop on the land and nothing else except a bunch of overgrown growth and trees. So we put up a small log cabin house, and we put in a garden. And being in the nursery business, I said, let's put some grapes in. I said, because I always wanted to grow grapes, because I always drank wine, because I used to be in the food and beverage business years ago. So we put in grapes, and the thought was at the time we would sell them to the Biltmore. And I was in touch with the grower of the Biltmore at that time, whose name escapes me. And he was telling me that, yeah, we'll buy your grapes when they come due. Well, you know, it takes 3 years after you plant them before you have any fruit. So when it did come done, come through to fruition, we were in a recession. And I called the Biltmore grower, and he had left then, he retired. And I talked to, probably talked to Bernard then, who was a winemaker. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. He said, we're not buying grapes off of anybody new this year. We would have been new to them. So what I should have done, I should have walked up and down every row and dropped every grape bunch on the ground and said, okay, we'll get them next year. But instead, stupidly, I said, well, why don't we make wine? So Karen and I got together, and she made a batch of wine, and I made a batch. Well, hers was a heck of a lot better than mine. Mine was pretty bad, and hers was pretty decent. So she became the winemaker by default, and I took care of the vineyard. She took the wine, and little by little, we grew and grew until finally it got to the point it was too much for Karen. So luckily, a fellow by the name of Michael Sterling, who's got a vineyard out in Oregon now and does winemaking, he introduced me to Justin, who was in the market then. He was working at Burnt Shirt, but he was looking to relocate. So I talked to him, and we got together, and it's been all uphill ever since. Justin's a winemaker. We have no problems with taking care of the wines. I said, Justin, you're the man, and he's been the man all the way, all along. We give him his full reign. He knows the wines better than we do, so he takes care of that end of it, and he is the winemaker. Then in 2019, Corey came on board. He spent 10 or 11 years in the Air Force, and he wanted to get out, and so I gave him a get out of jail card free.
That is not how I recall that, by the way.
And so he came up here, and he started doing the vineyard. I saw he liked it, and I said, well, this is my chance to back out doing any more damn work. I said, here, you can be me. And ever since then, I've been sitting in that throne you talked about, drinking wine and looking at TV.
You show up for interviews, and that's what matters. So.
Yeah.
We're honored to have you here today. So.
Well, you have wine. You have wine.
Yeah, we got wine because of Bob. So.
But it's been, I think, one of the biggest things too for me was I at that time, like Bob said, there was a mutual connection with somebody who I had taken over as predecessor at another facility. And it was an unannounced meeting for coffee. And I kind of had in the back of my mind of, where we were meeting. And I just ran through in my mind. And I thought there's only one place that I imagine would be looking to have somebody help them make the wine. And sure enough, I have a hard time being early for most things. But I was early to this meetup. And I was sitting in the coffee shop. And I saw Bob and Michael coming through the parking lot. And I was like, well, for me at that point, I was like, all right, I'm already agreed to join, because I knew
made him blush.
I think as far as my perspective goes for their sense of place, this was something that I had known just through the local industry. So yeah, I mean, it was very easy for me to be excited about jumping on board, but also was welcome with the fact that Bob and Karen both wanted more from what they had growing here. So, I mean, every year we have gone after what the next step is. I think that's probably the constant that we have. It's not staying still. It's what's next. So that's been a huge, huge opportunity.
And you started at a good place anyway, because Karen was doing a pretty damn good job with.
Yeah. And I mean, those were
the two of them. So
those were big things to wrestle with. And the first harvest, we were working out of the shop that Bob and Karen had built for their farm equipment when they were living in the log cabin, as Bob says. And I'll never forget that. I mean, because the first few days, I started in the spring of 17. So I was on for the growing season of 17 going into harvest. And that was, I mean, that means everything to some extent as it relates to a facility. And we got to start working out on the crush pad as harvest started. And we were using a bladder press. It ran off water and ran off copious amounts of water. And, you know, I don't think there's a point in anybody's time making wine that if they haven't seen the bladder explode on a water press, you like haven't checked all the boxes. And in that, yeah, and in that situation, it was just, you know, we were on our beat. Everything had been going along. We were working on processing fruit, you know, a few weeks of good consistency. And then I was out there one day. It was Karen Adolfo and I. And Karen was running the pressure up on the bladder press. And it was kind of, you know, it was at that point where you should say, okay, we're there.
Critical mass.
Yeah, critical mass. And we hung around critical mass a little too long. And I will never forget, because the minute the bladder exploded, the pumice flew out from underneath the cage, and the only person it hit directly was Karen, right in the face. So it was one of those like front row seats to a bad situation. We salvaged the juice that was coming out. Like everything about it worked out, except for the fact that I don't know how long it took Karen to get the pulp out of her hair. It's very, you know, and we jumped right into it. It was 17 on the old equipment, and then by 18 we had a small facility built out that was designed to try and take everything to the next step. So,
and I think you mentioned it too, like with the next step, like you've never stayed steady, like you've always been always increasing, always building up the next thing. I mean, you know, we're sitting here in the old building, but a new part of the old building, looking at the new building, it's just confusing. It's like, it's just like, okay, this is fun. But yeah, I think the point is you've always been improving year after year after year.
That's the hope. That's the goal always. Just trying to take the lessons learned from the year prior, apply them to the new season, and keep on keeping on, as it were. The way they built this place out, though, yeah, I mean, I would agree with you in the sense that it was... Well, we've never grown grapes before. We picked varieties with, you know, what we want to drink at the end of the day when Chardonnay, Merlot, and Cabernet. We want to first start growing fruit for the Biltmore Estate. Now we're making wine. So it's always been this snowball effect around here where it's like, all right, we try not to bite off more than we can chew. And that's probably the wrong way to say it, because we consistently bite off more than we can chew. But the way the place has been built from the get-go, it's a slow roll. And letting the business grow itself. And it's been doing that recently.
And the vineyard's been growing around it.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, we're just put 3 acres in the ground this past year. I'm getting ready to introduce another half acre this spring. Last year we did Malbec, Tannat, and Vidal Blanc. Definitely jumping on the hybrid train in the sense that Chamberson will get planted down here. We've always had, not always, but Chamberson was one of the first plantings after the initial block went in. It was the second block. It had a chunk of Chamberson in it, and those wines are becoming so much more widely recognizable from a consumer standpoint. And then certainly as a grower, I can say it's one of the few grapes that we grow that looks happy to be there in October. And, you know, it's one of those things that it speaks to you in a sense. So I've come a long way, because you always think about marketing. Right. And Chamberson on the East Coast is a lot easier to market than maybe say out West, but the wine style that Justin's created out of the fruit that we've been able to give him has been really well received, and yeah, we're putting more in the ground.
It's time again for Wine Class with Wine Mouths. Jesse and Jessica, welcome back.
Thanks.
We're on this journey through the history of wine. Where are we again?
So we've made it to the 1700s.
Which is the...
18th century.
Okay. Carry on. That.
All right. So here's a little context for what is happening in the 1700s, because it's a busy time period. So we start the early part of the 1700s. The very first newspaper is published in America. So things are happening in America. And we'll come back to that. Back in Europe, we've got the Seven Years' War, which lasts for...
7 years.
Wow. What a concept.
And in this war, Britain and Prussia defeat France, Spain, Austria, and Russia. France loses the North American colonies. Spain cedes Florida to Britain in exchange for Cuba. What? That's a lot. It's crazy. So that happened. Also in 1760, the Industrial Revolution begins in England. I'm not sure, like, how that was the defining date, but it is. So, like, you know, we're leaving our old ways behind, and we're headed forward into the Industrial Revolution. Back in the States, too, we get the beginning of the American Revolution in 1775, with the Constitution being signed in 1787. Jumping back to Europe, the French Revolution begins in 1789, and that's kind of the 1700s in a very abridged nutshell.
So many revolutions.
Lots of going on. Yeah. Lots of war. Yeah. Lots of
industrialization. Claiming of independence.
Yeah. Modernization, colonialization, all these things are still happening. So yeah, we're going to dig in a little bit.
Yeah. But so let's tell some stories.
Yeah.
So we're going to hop to Italy right now. So in Italy in the 1700s, we're starting to see some of the first wine laws and some of the first structuring of how we consider Italy now with wine. Hmm. So we're going to start with a little story about Chianti. So the Chianti area is spread between Siena and Florence, but it wasn't necessarily a wine region as quick as you may think. So there's a lot of strife between the Florentines and the Sienese. That's how you say that. And it prevented a lot of these vineyard projects through the hills of this area. So although we have the Chianti region, and we even had like a law in the 13th century protecting it, it was mostly protecting property and not really defining. The first time the word Chianti was applied to wine was in the 14th century, but it was a white wine.
Oh.
So there was red Chianti, but it was called Vino Vermiglio.
Sure. Vermiglio?
Yeah.
I don't know.
During the Renaissance or just Florence. They just called it Florence. When it was exported to London.
Thanks to the Brits for making it easy for us.
Exactly. But it wasn't liked very much because we don't really have corks yet. So it was sent uncorked in these flasks filled with olive oil and rags. And so, of course, yucky.
Oh,
right?
Well.
I can't imagine that aged or traveled well.
Right.
Or didn't spill in transit.
Yeah, exactly. So in enters the Medicis.
Medicis.
Who knew I
no,
learned
I
Italian at one point?
I think it's Medici's.
Nope,
I feel
you're
like
right.
There was
you're
a show, right?
Yeah,
there was
yeah.
a
Catherine, right?
Isn't it Medici's?
Medici's.
Medici's.
I don't know. I didn't watch the show.
Giovanni Unamella is the only Italian I know. So.
Well, anyways, in 1716, Cosimo de Medici issued an edict defining the boundaries of Chianti and some other regions. But we still don't quite get there with the wine yet, because most of this land was held by sharecroppers who gave their crop to the landlord. So we still don't really have like winemaking and that sort of thing. But things finally took a turn for the better. We get Baron Ricasoli, and he decided to run his estate, and he decided to do it all himself and not give it back to the landlord. So he's running his estate himself. And so he kind of laid the groundwork for the classic Chianti mix, which was Sangiovese and Cannaiolo. The grape.
It so, wasn't the olive oil.
Right. And the rags.
Or the pasta.
Were they like clean rags? Were they dirty rags?
Like,
I have a lot of questions.
But so this straw flask, right? So the bulbous flask glass was typical of this, but the glass was so thin, which is why they wrapped it in straw at the bottom, so it wouldn't break.
It was a fiasco.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. So it was called a fiasco in Italian, and it became kind of a joke.
Yeah. That's really interesting because we have talked about, maybe not on this podcast explicitly, but glass bottle development and how it, like technological advances changed wine corking and or like just wine bottling, I'm sorry, and transport and stuff. So that's really interesting that they created these straw flasks to help make it stronger.
Yep. Thankfully, now we have glass though.
No rags.
No rags.
I guess you use what you have.
Yeah.
All right, so that's Italy in the 1700s.
Yeah.
So we are going to jump to 1718 and to an abbey in Champagne. Did I get it?
No. It's like Champagne. Champagne.
Or champagne in English. And this abbey publishes a set of winemaking rules that's said to be established by Dom Perignon for quality winemaking. And it warned against using white grapes, Chardonnay, to keep wines from becoming sparkling from re-fermentation, which at that time was considered a wine fault. However, we know, of course, today Chardonnay is a desirable grape for sparkling winemaking in Champagne and elsewhere. So, anyways, kind of crazy that back then they saw it as a wine fault. Today we see it as something desired.
Who knew a failure could be so expensive?
Yeah, you got to fail up, right?
Yeah, and they did.
In a big way. In 1737, in Hungary, we get the first demarcated wine region of the world, in Tokaj. This is in the foothills of some mountains in Hungary, and it was demarcated to protect the sweet white winemaking tradition made from the ferment grape, and that had been made at that point for nearly 1,000 years, and so they're blocking it off and making it imported. Oh, I should have read this part before. Yeah, so we talked about Industrial Revolution. Throughout history, people have been modernizing and advancing and coming up with new ways to do things. And in 1740, glass bottles were redesigned. And they were redesigned to be laid on their side. So what this allows us at this point is now wines can be aged long-term. Also probably transported a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. You're not getting everything spilling out between those rags, those leaky, gross rags, and all the olive oil everywhere.
Just clay pots that don't sit upright.
Yeah. So they used molds to make bottles out of. And at this point in the record and history, we see molds that are closer to what we think of as like a modern wine bottle we still use today. And having these molds for glass bottles also allowed for the use of corks, which is a way better closure.
Yes.
Than dirty and or clean rags.
So technology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
All right. So now we're going to hop to Portugal. So during this time in Portugal, we have Britain signing the Methuen Treaty with Portugal in 1703. And so this Methuen Treaty was a military and commercial treaty between England and Portugal. And it was signed as part of the War of Spanish Succession. But the name comes from the representative for Britain was John Methuen. So, of course, they were the top dogs, so they got the treaty named after them.
He literally wrote history.
Yes. So it formalized existing trade patterns between Britain and Portugal, and it laid the groundwork for Portugal's economic dependence on Britain for the remainder of the 1700s, but specifically for wine. Portugal agreed to purchase English wheat, textiles, and manufactured goods in exchange for preferential duties on Portuguese products, specifically olive oil and wine.
Mm.
So, but to the start of this treaty, as usual, Britain and France were at odds. And so that's kind of how this stemmed, because a lot of people saw this. This was actually more of an anti-French treaty than it was a pro-Portuguese. But Britain had to figure out how they were going to get their wine if they were going to be at odds with France.
Mm-hmm.
So they picked Portugal. So the effects of the treaty, it started off well, right? Like the quality of wine, specifically port, because that's what we know of Portugal, coming from the Douro was good. Growers and shippers were happy. They were making money. But the rising demand couldn't be met by the Douro wine. And so shippers were growing greedy. Like they had all this demand. They wanted to make the Brits happy, but they didn't have enough. And so they started to kind of adulterate the wine, and they used wines from other parts of Portugal. They even used Spanish wines, which they called bullock's blood, which is fun. They would do raisin wine or cheap spirits to add in. But most notorious, which I found very interesting, was the addition of dried hot peppers and elderberries to provide like the heat from what was supposed to be alcohol and color.
No boy.
Oh.
Right.
I mean, that's
yeah.
Better than
like, yeah. Let's trick people to think they're drinking alcohol by just putting peppers mm-hmm. in the wine. So, anyways.
It burns.
But also, how sad bad for Portugal that they just hated the French so much. They're like, okay, this will do.
Yeah.
Raisin water, peppers, and yeah. That stuff.
Right. But, so we have this happening. In 1755, a large earthquake hits Lisbon, Portugal.
Wow, who could have seen that coming?
Right? Changes everything. 40,000 people were killed.
Oh, wow.
Which is a lot for the 1700s, right?
And also a small country.
Yeah. So the country went into chaos. The king was desperate for leadership and guidance, didn't know what to do. So he relied on his chief minister, who was first one guy, but then became Marquês de Pombal. And so he established monopolistic government power on different Portuguese activities, one of which being wine. So he created this really long Portuguese-named organization, but what we now know of as the Douro Wine Company. And it had two main goals. One, it wanted to get power back from these English merchants that were being wealthy and greedy and really causing a stink in the industry. And it wanted to restore pride and financial security to the Portuguese grape growers. So his new company had control over all port shipments, and even the English companies could only go ahead after they passed a tasting by the company. Mm. So the company was like, we're checking this wine that's leaving the port. Like, literally checking it. We're tasting it.
There better not be any peppers in this one.
Exactly. But... Exactly. He ordered all the elderberry trees to be uprooted. Not even giving people an opportunity to adulterate their wine. And all the vineyards had to be registered. So he got back to where the wines were getting their higher prices. And even today, these areas that he delimited with this are what they are today.
Wow. Do they grow elderberries?
I don't know. I wonder if they replanted.
Come back.
Wow.
That's crazy.
But that's what you get. You put elderberry in your wine.
That's why it smells of elderberry.
Yes. Man, that's wild.
Yeah. Well, we're going to hop countries now.
Yes. All right. We've
got more fun stories for
you. We're still on the European continent, but we are moving to Germany now. So by the late 1700s in Germany, quality wine was beginning to surface, and they put a really strong emphasis on this time, on Riesling. And there's a legend about that goes way back, kind of hand in hand with this, I guess. No, yes, it is about Riesling. Okay, so the background of this legend: there was a site in Rheingau that was picked out by our guy Charlemagne way back in the 8th century, which is also known as the
700s.
And it was very well known even
maybe
by
a track there.
Going backward. The Benedictines arrived back after this time, and they led the way in establishing this Rheingau space as a great wine producer. Then, wow, this is going way back. But the 30 Years' War ended in 1648, brought chaos to Germany. Things were not looking good. Vineyards were in a rotten state. Everything was bad. Nothing was good, but a guy named Prince Bishop of Fulda bought this monastery.
What a name.
I know, right? And he wanted to revive the estate and build himself a very nice castle.
Or Schloss.
I think castle sounds better.
Is that what you are if you have a lot of reasons?
Yeah, I think he was Schlossed. we fought 30 years for this Schloss. Anyways, okay, backing up. So here we are. We've gone back to 1775. And Fulda, the Prince Bishop, was 7 days away from Johannesburg. 7 days ride. So like today in a car, that might take us like 2 minutes. But
are we there yet?
No, not at all. And the vineyard manager sent a courier off to Fulda, 7 days ride away, asking for permission to pick the grapes. I'm not sure why he needed permission, but like they couldn't make their own choices. I mean, he's the Prince Bishop, so I guess that makes sense. But we don't know what the courier was doing, but he was late. Yeah. Hmm. No one knows. He did not write about it in his diary. But when he finally got back to the vineyards, it was past time. The grapes were all shriveled up. They were rotten, shriveled with rot. And it was just too bad that all the neighboring estates had long finished their harvest, but here they are just twiddling their thumbs at this Schloss. Just waiting. So Anyways, they just are waiting for this.
Yeah,
the word.
Right. Like, can you imagine everybody picking grapes around you and you're just like,
yeah,
nope.
I mean, he must have been pretty serious, because if they picked him and he got mad, like, they must have been really scared of what he would do.
Bishop is going to hate it.
Ooh. Yeah.
But yeah, so why not still pick the grapes and then make wine? So,
I mean, rotten grapes. Why not?
Yeah, you use what you have. Maybe they had, well, they had clearly a lot of free time on their hands. Because if they're just waiting around to not pick grapes, then it's fine. So the next February, it finally stopped fermenting. And it was rich and it was sweet. And actually, it turned out it was okay. I like that poor man who had to be the first one to taste test. Like, you try it. You do it. But yeah, it turned out actually really great. And so most of the grapes in this Riesling-only vineyard had been affected by a noble rot before the harvest began. So this happy accident actually laid the groundwork for the sweet wine, which we know is now, well, now under the German regulations and naming, is termed Spätlese, which means late harvest. And so from this time, 1700s, late harvest wines from grapes affected by noble rot on purpose have been produced on purpose. And so the subsequent differentiation of wines based on the ripeness at which they are harvested started in 1787, starting with Auslese, and it laid the groundwork for the Pratica system, which is in effect through today.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you, Schlosh.
Which means castle.
Castle. But thank you, Fulda. And this courier, like, what do you think he was doing?
He was getting schloshed.
He was in the woods getting schloshed.
Now I'm wondering, like, where does that word come from?
Probably something along the lines of that.
We're going to have to get a Google rabbit hole after this.
Yeah. He was at the wrong schlosh.
All right, so moving to the United States now.
Yeah.
We're here.
I believe this is rounding up our 1700s.
Yeah. So winemaking came to California with the Spanish missionaries, and they were the first Europeans to settle in California. So Spain had occupied Mexico and established 21 missions up the coast of California. So the goal of the missions, as most missions at this time, they wanted to expand territory for Spain. They wanted to convert the indigenous peoples to Christianity, and they wanted to develop their resources and send all the money back to Spain. So the missionaries were led by a Franciscan friar, Jonathan.
Doesn't sound very Spanish.
That's an American name.
It should be Juan or something like that.
Junipero Cerro.
Father Junipero Cerro, who was a, I
think Jonathan is his American name. Do you want to redo it or leave
Can we
it?
Say the name again?
We're sloshed.
So the missionaries were led by a Franciscan friar, Father Junipero Cerro, who established the first mission in San Diego in 1769. And soon after, he wrote letters about the difficulty and cost of attaining wine from Mexico, so they were very motivated to produce their own wine. There were native grapevines growing in California, but as we know with the native grapevines in the United States, they weren't suitable for winemaking for what the folks wanted at the time. So they started importing vinifera cuttings to grow their grapes. There's some dispute exactly when and where the first vineyard was established, but it was in the 1700s, so 1778, and the first vintage of wine came 4 years later in 1782. Eventually, grapes were planted at all but two of the missions. So the two missions that couldn't grow grapes were San Francisco and Santa Cruz because they were too cold and foggy. But the Los Angeles mission was the most extensive vineyard because it had the best climate. And the first grapes grown were the mission grapes, or país, what it was called in Chile. But so those were the first grapes. And they actually used wooden platforms lined with animal skins to put the grapes on to get the juice, kind of to press the juice out.
Mm.
Hmm.
Yeah.
A little hint of gaminess. So just to kind of round up the 1700s, it was a time of revolution and change. So we get the Declaration of Independence in 1776, at which they toasted that signing with Madeira. So bringing it full circle. But also, what? Did I still say it wrong? Okay. and the Constitution was signed in 1787. But then, right, so we are doing our thing in America, and then back in France, they've got the French Revolution from 1789 to 1791. And why this is important for wine is because the rise of Napoleon after the French Revolution meant that the church, which is an important keeper of wine knowledge and all that important stuff, the church lost a great deal of their power after the French Revolution, and also land, as the land went back to private owners. And so we're going to see how that change impacts things, you know, kind of coming up next. So to wrap this wild 100 years up, we've got some food pairings, because we're going to dig deep and come up with some food pairings for this. So we started our discussion with Italy and Chianti. So we're thinking about food pairings for a classic Chianti. So of course you got to go Italian, obviously. So spaghetti and meatballs or lasagna, of course, pizza are going to go. Any of those things would pair nicely with Chianti. We also talked about port in the Douro region. So with port, that's a nice, easy pairing with cheese, any amount of cheese, all the cheese, any kind of cheese would be great. Well, maybe not any kind, but a lot of cheeses.
Well, the classic pairings, like Stilton.
Yeah, Stilton. There we go. Also, of course, chocolate desserts, right? People love to pair ports with desserts. For example, a molten lava cake might be over the top. I could go for one of those. we also talked about Riesling and the importance in the Schloss at that time. and Rieslings are a fun one because, you know, you could definitely go German pairing, but here at the Wine Mouth, we prefer more unusual pairings with a Riesling, like Chinese takeout or spicy Thai food. Something a little bit more unusual, unexpected. And we also hit a little bit on the Pais grape and just like the Mission grape and that influence.
Which is having a comeback.
Hmm. Yeah.
Being produced out of Chile, not California, but.
Yeah. So this rather, you know, run-of-the-mill, like easy-going wine could pair nicely with Mediterranean food or Spanish tapas, Greek food and appetizers, things like that. Could be a nice pairing. So, what a wild ride.
Well, I was just sloshed from all of that. So that was a 100 years.
And so many revolutions that happened that time.
Yeah.
The drop of a hat felt like nothing.
Well, we look forward to the 19th century next time.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, we will talk again soon.
Thanks.
You can find out more information about the Wine Mouths by going to their website, winemouths.com, or on Facebook and Instagram at Wine Mouths. That's WineMouths. And now, back to the show.
So let's talk about the vineyard a little bit more. So maybe let's go back to where it started and then talk about, you've given us a little hint of where you're at now, but let's walk through kind of the evolution of the vineyard.
If you look out that window, you see these Chardonnay plants. That's where we started, and we went that way toward White Oak Mountain, and we just went down. We said, well, we drink Chardonnay, we drink Merlot, we drink Absinthe, we drink Cab Franc, and that's how we planted them along the way. And you know, when they were little babies, we didn't have any irrigation because we were dry farming. So I had like almost 1,000 feet of hose that I was dragging, watering the vines, and you just can't pull the hose because you have to go and put it over each vine. And so you would go a few vines and drop it, and then you could water more. And I did that for the whole damn first year.
We're still doing it in year 14.
Well, close, but not exactly.
Dry farming.
Well, we're still dry farming.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're like Bordeaux and Burgundy. We dry farm.
I agree. And that there is something about that with the whole, I mean, it's not a part of sustainable farming, but it definitely is a part of that conversation that's catching a lot of fire right now.
And we do get a lot of rain around here.
Yeah, well, there's plenty, typically. But to go back to the vineyard as it was started, the block that Bob just described is what I would, you know, which is dubbed the Heritage Vineyard. That's kind of where it all began. He planted what I described as Norte, which is this block over here. It's a Chardonnay block. And then they started to put a little bit more Merlot. Petit Mansin came into the fold right around 2012. Got into the Chambersin at that same time, and Muscat Giallo became a part of the growth here, and we've since taken the Giallo clone with its availability being the biggest issue, and the fact that it would rather stare at the Mediterranean than at pine trees. We grow Cornell's clone, Valvin Muscat, so we're planting a good chunk of that this spring. And then, like I said, last year we did the Malbec Tannat and Vidal Blanc. But we've also added in the last few years Petit Verdot and expanded upon some Merlot and Petit Mansang as well.
I don't know whether you noticed, but as you drove in the entrance here on Whiteside Road, to your right, there's 5 acres of woods, which we're clearing now to put in more grapes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, nice. Okay. So how much would that...
I did notice that there was that was different.
Yeah.
There is always something different every time we come.
So how many acres would that put you at?
Total
20,
acres.
Maybe.
Don't ask me.
Don't ask
Justin.
But don't ask Bob either.
Justin only counts to where the grapevine sits. I say no, it's a whole damn row.
That's it. So, I mean, yeah, as far as square footage planted here, if you wanted to put it that way, right now producing, we were just under 9. We just put another 3 in the ground.
Cool.
So, yeah, we're right there at 12.
12 acres?
Producing.
I think you're a little short, but we'll go with 12.
What's all right? So if we put in
4 more, that'll give us 16. Okay. Oh, and then that other area where we're going to plant the box, 16, that'll give us another 3. That'll give us 19 acres.
I can't wait for a new press.
It sounds like you're going
to
need it.
That's
why I asked you about the tanks, because when we have enough to fill up everything, it would absorb. I've learned you have to do everything in systematic style. When we started, I just said, oh, you need tanks. I knew nothing about it when we started it, and I made a lot of mistakes. You know, if anybody was getting into wine business, my advice would be go work in a vineyard and a winery for a year or two, learn what you're doing, and then you won't waste a lot of your own money if you get into it yourself, because believe me, you waste a lot of money if you start without any knowledge of what the business is like.
That's some good advice.
For sure.
It's also what, like, I think a lot of our customers, because that story essentially gets told to every person that comes through the door. And so many people look at that and just imagine tenacity. And I'm like,
that's
one word for it. He was 72 years old too when they started this thing.
Yeah, so when we came here, I was 72 and Karen was, I don't know, 60 something or other. And we were out there planting vines on our hands and knees, pulling wires, putting in posts, and I thought, oh, we can do this forever. It's a learning curve. You can't.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. I keep remembering the first few times we came here, and it was just you and Karen. I think one time in particular, used to every time we would come over in this area, it would rain, as Bob mentioned. So it was a Sunday, and it was pouring rain. We got here not long after you'd open, and we just sat for like an hour or hour and a half. You were just pouring wine, and we were talking, and it was just the four of us in this room over here, and just that experience kind of set that. Okay, this is a place we want to come back to regularly.
You would be surprised how many people come up to me today and say, you know, we miss it when you were down there in the other tasting room, because we had time and we all would sit and talk, drink wine and sit and talk. And it was more chum-like, you know, more low-key, more friends. Like, now people say, oh, you've gotten too big. I said, no, we're just paying the bills.
Yeah, exactly. I know, it's good to see that evolution. I'm glad I was here when it was smaller, but it's not like you're massive corporate place. You're still very much a family run operation, obviously, and that
we can't even find
through.
A good accountant. That's our next project, to find a good accountant.
Good luck with that.
That's all yours.
No, I mean, I remember the balance of working with, at that time, when the tasting room and the winery were literally across the street from each other on this little part of the property. And I worked at that time, I worked Wednesday through Sunday. And I think I worked 3 days a week. And then 2 days I would usually like host whoever came from the tasting room over into the winery. Or I would wander over to the winery and, you know, Bob would be sitting in a rocking chair on the far side. And that was, and that like, it all made sense. It all had a fit to it. And then I think, I don't think that there was any part of moving to the top end of the property where there's any regrets, because now, you know, when you're up there, you 100% have one of the best views in the county. It's a beautiful perspective on what's down here. So if you were to try and do the snapshot 14 years down the road, it's up there. But, you know, and again, we still from time to time have folks come down and we'll hang out in the winery. But these days I do get a little more done. Five days a week.
I like down here by yourself.
Probably good.
I am down here by myself. And that actually, that helps, because it definitely is, you know, getting in the zone and making sure I'm focused on stuff. But during harvest, it's definitely a matter of having help. And with bottling, it's a matter of having help. But there's sometimes where it's just almost having nothing going on but your thoughts as to what you're trying to do is also helpful. Not about being in like an echo chamber, but being able to just kind of sit down and make a decision over something it's not a short-term task. Everything about it is long-term. So
that's the tractor for me.
Yeah.
Right.
It's your meditative space.
Yeah, out in the vineyard. Kind of try to make sure that you're at least going in the right direction.
Not necessarily
what you're driving, but where you're trying to steer the ship that is the vineyard and the winery and everything else. No, I mean, it's been fun watching it grow. My only regret is not getting here sooner. And, you know.
Amen. I wish I would have gotten here sooner. I would have, you know, I really would have loved to have gotten here when I was much younger. I mean, because it's an interesting life. I mean, and there's so many aspects. I mean, I started reading about marketing. I mean, because I never, everything we grew down in Florida for trees, there was a demand. We didn't have to market them. People just came in and bought them. But here you have to market what you sell, and it's a whole new field, and I enjoy it, though. I mean, I really do. It's interesting. I think it keeps my brain alive.
Absolutely. And the other thing, too, is that the North Carolina industry is so young that there's not even a footprint that you could look back on. I mean, we're barely at the point where, and I maybe could consider myself a second gen, where I can look back at the pioneers who established and try and do like a quick and dirty review of what's working and what's not working. And that is the only point where you can actually start your second phase of, all right, is the selection of what we're growing correct? Is how we're growing it correct? Is how we're making the wines correct? And then at the end of the day, all of that is only justified correct if there are people, Bob says so, and there are people who come out and enjoy what you're doing. Because to me, at the end of the day, and I have always kind of had this in the back of my mind since I started this from like an educational perspective, you can do whatever you want, and then if nobody drinks it, you only got one shot at it. So that was it. So for continuity, I mean, you've got to try and at least understand the long term the long-term implications of what you're doing.
I mean, that's in every field too. So like you said, what's working? I think of that obviously from like a cultivar selection perspective, but then on the flip side of that coin, we can talk about that. But what's working as far as like our attitude or our approach to how we do business in the tasting room? I mean, you guys go to a lot of wineries. I like to think that there's plenty of them that are kind of in this breath, but we have definitely embraced the idea of being unconventional in our atmosphere, in the sense that, you know, you can touch the furniture, you can come have a good time. If you need a quiet place to go because the music, the live band is just too much for you, we try to provide that. But again, if you want to be in the middle of the party, you came to the right place, because we try to have a good time and not take the fun out of wine. Because, I mean, you mentioned it, you have memories of sitting down here and talking with them.
Right.
That's what's in the glass, right? So we just try to make memories for people. And
I was just going to add to that. What Corey says is accurate there, because what we try to do, we have a customer who builds these Adirondack chairs, and he's built quite a few for us. And we sort of put them out on the peripheral of the lawn where people can sit and look and take in the view and just be serene. And I mean, I like to do that myself once in a while. I'll just sit there and sit and you think, and it, you know, it's peaceful. Lowers your blood pressure.
It's always high. Then you go to the flip side of the coin on cultivar selection, and you're like finding our path. And Justin mentioned being that it's like we're a young industry. I mean, I consider myself to be the number one poster boy on Petit Manseng. I mean, I feel like this grape is telling us that it wants to be here. In the style that the wine can be, the versatility that it brings. I mean, we've made this wine three or four different ways, just kind of trying to find our style. And we have, from a growing perspective, I mean, we've often joked, we feel like you could grow it on the moon. The biology, physiology of the grape, it's one of those looser clusters with thick skins. And, you know, 18, we had 83 inches of rain here. Petit Manseng was there for us. I don't know that we could have said that for anybody else in the field.
Yeah.
You know, we planted Tanat because it was heralded by friends of ours on the coast as the hurricane grape. Then you take into like the weather that we're having right now with the early frosts and early screaming hot temperatures followed by crazy cold temperatures, by more hot temperatures. The roller coaster that is the spring here in Western North Carolina. And, you know, it is built for what we do out here in the western part of the state. And I feel like I can say that with zero question whatsoever. The only gripes I've ever heard for it is its yield. But it's a grape that, you know, we can trellis things different ways. I've never had to put Petit Manseng on the ground. Never had to drop that fruit. Because it'll just sit there and keep gaining sugar. And gosh, you hope the acid is falling out of it. But
that's a true statement.
Yeah, it brings some legit acid.
It does. You need that lower.
Our Petit, and I don't know if you guys tried it or not, but while you were up at the tasting room. But yeah, I mean, we're shooting for that ML vibe. I mean, Justin can certainly speak better on the style than I. But it's been very well received thus far. In fact, we just sent some with Dan and Kathy to NC Wines for this year's comp yesterday.
It's the wine style that I think creates a big picture relationship, because it is from, at the end of the day, this is farming. Because if we can't grow the crop, then there's nothing to bring to the crush pad. And the less that we have fought with that grape, it comes into the winery and it behaves. I get to choose exactly where that wine goes. And I think the only thing that you know that I have learned to have a caution over is that balance in alcohol and acid. There's a freshness to it though that I think lives in the wines of Western North Carolina. I think it has great fruit tones. We've always tried to have good at aromatic whites. I mean, that's Karen's thing. So, you know, to be able to get in behind that and try and lift some tropical notes and then try and balance it on the mouthfeel, those are the creative outlets of making a wine that it showed up with everything it needed. All you had to do was kind of guide it into its last little spot. And I think those over and over again are the wines that will continue to show for longevity, not being something where we're like really just forcing something. And I think after a while, that's the lesson that I feel like, it's a tough one to learn, but I think that's the lesson that I feel like goes the longest, is when you don't have to fight with something between the vineyard and the bottle, then you find that it's actually gonna work for you, not against you. And that's how I've felt for a while. But even then, you know, and I think, I don't know if it was Bob or Bob asked Corey or Corey came out. Anyways, we had a conversation at one point and it was like, how many different ways could you make Petit Manseng? And at the end of the day, I literally sat down and was like, I could cut this thing up 5-10 different ways. What kind of wine would you like to make it?
You could go straight German Sauvignon like you did in the past with, you know, dessert wine styles or these like super viscous, you know, high alcohol. Because I mean, it's making sugar out there. It'll do it for you every year.
It's crazy.
And then you go to that table wine. You could go for that malic finish if you can hopefully get the acid to fall out of it. But we're so hot down here some seasons, man, that like it's not as much of an issue here maybe as it would be in a colder climate or cooler. If you know, like if Eric is growing it on the mountain, you know,
at 3,000, 3,500 feet, it'd probably be a beast. I mean, I've heard of some pretty crazy chemistries with petit ginseng and that sort of an environment. But, you know, the same thing could be said for Merlot. I mean, that's a red grape that I think in Polk County does really well. The wines that it produces are relatively consistent. The grape grows are pretty consistent. It's like late enough in the spring that it's not always at risk. Like the weather we just had, it was completely unaffected. It wasn't even peaking out quite yet. So we still have it delayed prune to kind of try to get to the other side of the full moon in April, which is like this very, very soft metric that we used to watch the last cold event for the year. And then the soil profile down here, that dense red clay on this side of the Blue Ridge, Merlot right bank. I always go back to this in the tasting room. It loves that red clay there. I'm not saying that we're Pomerol because we're not. However, there is something to it. I mean, especially this year's, I feel like I can taste the soil in this current Merlot that's on the shelf up there right now.
It's awesome.
And you shouldn't say we're not. You should say we're not yet.
Oh, fair enough.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Pomerol was Pomerol until it became Pomerol.
No, but you're both. It's okay.
That's right. It's close enough.
Yeah. It seemed that ABA seemed to be a thing. And yeah, the neighborhood's doing well down here.
Yeah, we're having Corey put together the ABA.
Alongside Joe Forrest. He did.
Well, you worked with Joe Forrest and got that going. That's very good.
Yeah, I mean, Corey gave it legs again. Because there was a point where I almost want to say that third time is a charm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there were two attempts, one of which I had a little glimpse on, one I did not, and then Corey very much pushed it.
Well, I think by the time I got here, like the question had come up a few times, like why hasn't this happened? And I saw the value in it. I've been asked like why do an ABA? I don't know. It's hard to say, man. Is it just validation that your area does something exceptional?
Sure. It's at least that, but I think there's more to it than that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, sure, it helps you market. Sure, you can write a state on your label, state grown on your label once you achieve that and you own that. But for me, what I was getting to was there was less hands in the pile, so to speak, by the time I got to it. So I think we were all in agreement on what we were going to call it, which I think in most cases is probably the biggest standoff with folks, right?
Like, well, the first time around, it was a naming.
Yeah, so I mean, Tryon Foothills, I mean, those two words are peppered around the western part of the state here, from the Humane Society to Tryon International Equestrian Center. So, I mean, there's no issue getting that by as far as the TTV was concerned. It was really just, they just needed somebody to say, hey, I need the money, and we're getting the geologist, whatever he needed from varieties in the area. You know, we're trying to draw consistencies among varietals that were grown from here to Overmountain, to Mountain Brook Vineyards, to Russian Chapel. So, you know, and there were some consistencies throughout. Sure, that some of those guys are growing stuff that we don't and vice versa, but I think Petit Mansang is going to show up all over the neighborhood.
Yeah,
you'll have to clear that one up with your next interview. At least I hope so.
And I mean, there's such a unique growing situation here. I don't know that the densities of these crowns, as far as these foothills go, it's a very unique space because they're not large rolling pastures. You're dealing with different facets in the land profile. You're very close to, you know, 1,000-foot elevation difference. And I think that the soils here reflect it, but the terrain really reflects it. And I mean, at this point, I feel like it's very much underutilized, considering all the rainfall that we do get. That's, you know, a slope helps with kind of mitigating where that water gets into the soil profile. So, and around here, there's definitely choice sites that are still untouched, I believe.
Looking at one right now.
Yeah.
Down to that hill back there.
That's it for this episode of Cork Talk.
Join us again next month as we wrap our conversation with Bob, Corey, and Justin. There might even be a special guest who joins us.
If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and review. It helps others find Cork Talk and lets us know how we can improve.
And don't forget to follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at NC Wine Guys. Until next time, and remember, a cork only talks when it's out of the bottle. Cheers!
Cork Talk.
Talk is a Free Run LLC production.
This episode was made possible in part by a grant from the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council.